Souls which have passed away are nearer to us in one way than those on earth. But in another way, they are further. I love Murshid, you know, it's like, he says this and then he says that, right? It's like this balance, right? Okay. Well, it's interesting when we think about it. He goes on to say, they are nearer in the way that if they want to get in contact with us, or we with them, it is more easily done than with the souls on the earth. But when we look at the difference between the plane on which they live and our plane, they are further than those on earth, because there's no means of communication here. Because there's more means of communication here. So we can text, or we can call, or we can Facebook, or whatever, but we have to, it's a kind of attunement, isn't it, to communicate in another way. And you'd always be surprised, you know, how that can happen. I remember a student of mine, I knew his mother had breast cancer and she was very ill, and I was close to him, and he came one day and he was just standing in my office. It was just this look of, I don't even know how to describe the look. And I said, "Tom, what is it?" And he said, "My mom died." I said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "I didn't know where else to go." I said, "Well, come in and close the door." And I said, "You know, your mom now will be able to communicate with you in and through everything, but it's up to you to be open and responsive." I said, "For example, I had this dream of my father," and my father passed away very unexpectedly and suddenly about 12 years ago. And I said, "I had this dream that," and my dad did crazy things, like if we didn't talk for a while, he'd draw a picture, and it'd be like a telephone ringing, and it's like, "Call sometime," you know, it was all those kinds. He made his own little greeting cards. And I said, in the dream, I realized I could talk to him on the telephone. And I was telling my sister, "Did you know we could call Dad on the telephone, even though he's dead?" And at that moment, the phone rang. And I said, "Dad calling." So you know, there's little things, favorite flowers or fragrances or a quote or a food or something. Anyway, Marcia talks more about it. I told you to stay tuned. I'm going to give it to you. Okay. Souls which have passed away are engaged in doing the same thing that they were doing before. Be careful. Be mindful. Their world is more beautiful than nature on earth, for mind is nature also. Mind is an improvement upon nature, and it is part of nature at the same time. For instance, the idea of paradise is an improvement upon nature. And while on earth, paradise is an imagination, in the hereafter, the same paradise will become a reality. So think about it. When Murshid says, "Heal us body, heart, and soul," it means something. He doesn't say heal our mind, but he says heal our heart, which is the feeling dimension. The feelings become more subtle than the thoughts. You understand what I'm saying? And the heart can be receptive to those feelings. So if that's true, and we're here doing these practices to polish our heart, they will therefore help clarify the mind. You understand? So I'm again suggesting to practice, because these vibrations are indeed what we will be taking with us. And what we emanate now around us. Practice. You don't have to sit and do it. You don't have to take 20 minutes and do it. You can do it all the time. You open the door for someone, Ya Fatah. You enter the room, Bismillah. You know, whatever that is, Our Father who art in heaven, Our Father who art in heaven. Our Father, Mother, excuse me. Our one and only being in heaven and all the earth.
Just to clarify what I think that you're saying is if we are creating this vibration through our practice in embodiment and we take that with us, would that mean that we then, in a different, not necessarily same type of consciousness way, but we then could have that positive influence on the sphere once departed?
I believe so. I believe that's what Murshid's telling us, and he did tell us that yesterday, in fact. In another message volume, it's the one on the mind world, he makes this very clear to us that these vibrations will be the reality that we will live in the future. Because when we lose the body, it is the mind, the heart, the soul that goes on, and these things carry those vibrations. You know, it's like the book. Have you read the book? I'm forgetting the author again. Maybe Raheem can help me. The Tipping Point. Does anyone know that book?
Heard of it. I haven't read it.
I want to say the author's last name is Nash, but I'm not sure. But the whole, I mean, he goes through sort of a series of sociological studies, and he talks about the influence of that on marketing, in environments, in social structures. And one of the things there is actually philosophy about is the broken window theory, that all it takes is one broken window that doesn't get repaired in an environment, it can bring the whole neighborhood down. And we've seen that happen. One thing boarded up, the next thing you see, it's like that. There's a kind of energy to that. And people then, it has a ripple influence. And contrarily, the other can be true. Ollie Cotter and I were talking about this morning on the path because we both lived in the same house, and then later we lived on the same block. And I said, you know, the little gardens that he's creating in this environment, it's a challenged neighborhood, let's say. But the little block is beautiful. It's, you know, Ollie Cotterville or whatever we're calling it now.
Larryland.
Larryland. Yeah. And, you know, he's planted all these flowers and he's created this beauty. And when I had moved back, the little house that I bought was kind of in disrepair. We fixed it up, and then pretty soon everyone in the neighborhood started doing things. So you can have that influence. That's a more mundane example, but it's an example nonetheless. People started taking more pride in fixing up their properties and painting and doing things like that. And you say that the ice cream man comes down, keeps driving down the block and stopping to enjoy the flowers. How lovely is that? And then could I tell about the lot across the street? Yeah, there's this big lot across the street that has never was put there, right? And it's at the end of a dead-end street, so that whole property I always considered our yard, too. But the man wanted to know, who owns that? And Ollie Cotter said, I do. And he said, you want to sell it? He said, no, it's my front yard. It's like a continuation of the front yard, you know. It's nice. So keep holding out, Ollie Cotter. The neighborhood needs you.
I have a question.
Yes, Alima.
Fear of punishment, out of fear of a punishment reward, like, well, I better do a good job now or else, or is that kind of what I've...
Oh, it's interesting that you would, yeah. I personally do believe in the laws of cause and effect. Do you? Mm-hmm. Well, it's like that at every level.
Yeah.
But Murshid said yesterday, don't you remember? If you don't learn it on your way here or while you're here, you'll learn it on the way back. Do you remember? He gives us that glimmer of hope. And people have their own, I call it kind of a trajectory, you know. It's like, I remember one of my dear friends, Tupten Jigme, he was the chant master at Nechung Monastery, and there were these, you know, for them to take up debate in Buddhist dialectics is very challenging. You have to have a very clear mind. Not everyone wants to do it, although it's good for them to do it. And so he was just laughing about it one day, that people that weren't taking their studies seriously, he said, it's just their karma, you know. There wasn't any judgment. It's just their karma, you know. It's not the situation in this life, at least from that point of view, had not ripened yet. We might think of that in terms of our own consciousness. Maybe there's it hasn't ripened yet. But I think I do believe our practices. I know this from my own experience. I can't tell you that or make you understand or believe it. You have to know it from your own experience. But the practices have totally revolutionized my life and my thinking and my world. And anyone that's known me for a long period of time knows that's true. So I don't think it's so much we have to worry about being punished. No, we get enough of that. It happens, right? It was like I was saying something about, I don't even know who, I might have been saying something about my sister in jest today. And you know, I had my sunglasses and they just like fell apart in my hand. And I said, there it is, Bozsa Skoda on me, you know, like negative energy. You know, it was like it was a good reminder. And the mother of Sri Aurobindo Ashram, she always says, when you have an accident, trace what was your thought just before that happened. What was that energy just before it happened? You know, falling, slipping, whatever it might be. Like, what was the energy you were in at that moment?
I can't help but just maybe give her some solace on her question. It seems like I've read this more than once. There's a great, great, great saint, you know, he's totally enlightened, and the Brahmin goes to him and says, how long, and he's practiced, you know, just stoically, Spartanly for his whole life, and how much longer before I'm enlightened? The saint says, 5 lifetimes. He goes away so bummed out and dejected, he's depressed. It's like, 5, I've worked so hard, it's like... So then the untouchable has done nothing, you know, just scrounging to live, and I guess he's around that. He gets his way up. He says, oh, saint, he says, how long before I'm enlightened? He goes, 1,000 lifetimes. He is so happy that he even
has an idea that it's going to happen.
He's 1,000 lifetimes. And of course, he becomes enlightened, and the saint goes to hell or something. I mean, the other guy. That was vanity.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Did we even answer your question, Alima? It's good to wrestle with that, you know? Because for me, I do think, you know, I call myself the quick karma kid. You've probably all heard that expression, but it happens pretty quickly, like the broken sunglasses in the hand.
I think that my concern is what I tend to do is I'm really kind of, I'm like, blaming myself for everything that goes wrong.
Oh.
And so,
okay.
How to do it, how to create beauty, because I want to create beauty, not because I'm afraid.
Yeah. Okay, so can I tell you a story? Are you all up for this story? It's kind of, I think it applies, and some of you have heard it before. Can you be patient to listen to it? So, yes or no? Because I can move on.
Yes.
So I was living in Dharamsala, a lot of you know that, and I was working with the Tibetan refugees. And quite frankly, I was spending a lot of time helping other people. And of course, some of my friends were critical, and it's like, oh, you should be at Tushita doing, you know, all these retreats, or you're wasting your time. Of course, in the meantime, I'm with my Rinpoche. I get to see him every day. I'm living at the monastery, and so on and so forth. But I was busy, because a lot of people had asked me to do things, you know, and they were important things, you know, like I was at His Holiness, the school, the Institute of Buddhist Dialectics, I was teaching English vernacular to the Rinpoches that were planning to come to the West, and, you know, and I was helping the some of the monastics learn English, and so, and that's the one key. If you travel the world, you have people from Germany and France and Finland and wherever, and what are they speaking so they can speak to each other? It's English. It's the great key in communication in the world. Such a blessing to know that. They were very eager to learn it. So anyway, at one point, now I was getting ready to leave the country. And I had asked, I had entrusted someone that I really thought would do it for me to take my open-ended plane ticket to Delhi. I mean, it was their business. And get my plane ticket for my return. And he didn't do it. And this was going to mean maybe I wasn't going to be able to return on this plane ticket. And it was, I think it just, it was like this last straw, like I was so stretched, and this was one thing I'd asked someone to do, and they let me down. And I ran into them. His Holiness was doing an afternoon puja with the monks, and I kind of, you know, my energy was like, I rushed in the temple door, and he just kind of looked over at me, and he just kind of went, like he kind of knew, you know, he could tell. And he asked, he just kind of went like this, you know, to sit down with the monks, like this. And then that, at that point when it was over, he speaks Tibetan, he understands some English, but he speaks Tibetan. I know very, very little Tibetan, so he sent one of the monks to go to the Institute of Buddhist Dialectics. That was the advantage of teaching there, because a translator would come right away. And so he just so gently took my hands, and you know, Rinpoche's very high being. I mean, he is the tantric master to His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. And he doesn't sit on the ground. He always, you know, in that tradition, he sits on a throne. So he took me and he walked me over, hand in hand like this. And the very first throne that was ever built for His Holiness in exile is in Rinpoche's temple, was given to him as a gift. So he, you know, asked me to sit down, touching the throne, and he sat down with me. And then he said, so this maybe will answer you in a good way, I hope. I said, oh, and he said, you know, asked me what was wrong. I told him the story. He said, listen, I mean, this is the way it was translated. You're doing a lot of good. And as a result, your own negative karma has come to fruition. He said, consider it a great blessing that that's been expended. So when bad things are happening, you might take that point of view. That maybe there's also a blessing that some obstacle is being removed. Does that make sense? And, you know, I just want to remember Comte Rinpoche in this moment. He's such a great being. He transcends, really, space and time. The way Darvesha this morning was speaking about moving the hand, this is exact, and his hands are beautiful. They're like, every motion is just exquisite. And it's like there's light that comes from his hands. And, you know, when he reaches and he picks up a piece of bread, you know, he actually really looks at it. Everything is like that. Everything. And I've been with him morning, noon, and night. There's such consistency no matter what is going on around him. It's quite incredible. So really something to aspire to and witness, you know, try to absorb. But I hope that helps a little bit. Just consider, change the point of view, and don't, by all means, it's not meant to punish oneself. When one can seek to see the hidden hand of God in everything. In everything. And here's another little tip. You're not the master of the universe, so don't think you have that much power. or the mistress of the universe. Do you know what I'm saying? It's not God. We all wish you were. You could give us enlightenment in this moment. Maybe you can. Who knows? Okay. Does that help? It's like lighten it up. And when you, something does happen, one does fall, one can watch one's thought and say, okay, guess what? I've hurt my foot, now I get to relax a little bit. Let people do things for me. I mean, you know, it can all be turned into a blessing. It's a point of view. So now, to create happiness for oneself and others, therein lie the whole of religion and the whole of philosophy. So we've heard the purpose of life, and now we're hearing the whole of religion and the whole of philosophy, which, by the way, I do want to say, we have to remind everyone that Sufism isn't really a religion. It's an attitude. It's a philosophy. In the traditional schools of Sufism, Sufism is the course of study that is philosophical. It's different than theology. It's very different. So understand that. Okay? Take that in. And you can make of it what you wish, but it's not a religion. It really isn't. And Murshid says that again and again. So it's teaching us a kind of attitude or philosophy towards life. To create happiness for oneself and others, therein lie the whole of religion and the whole of philosophy. After passing away, some remain under the impression of death for a long time. But one cannot compare the time of this earth with the time of the other worlds. The time of the next world is no longer, I'm sorry, the time of the next world is much longer than the time of this world. The deeper the impressions are, the longer one has to remain in purgatory. And Murshid mentioned purgatory again yesterday. So think about that. The impressions, the deeper those impressions are, the longer we remain in this quasi-state, neither here nor there. So again, another reason to practice, right? It's like polish, you know, we give that analogy of polishing the mirror of the heart, you know, or like polishing the car, you know, get the scratches out of it, buffing it, you know, make it shiny, beautiful and bright. And as I said yesterday, you know, consider one's own suffering as an offering for those poor souls in purgatory. Offer it up. I love that story. I've said it. Did I talk about the little children of Fatima yesterday? You know the story about the three shepherd children with the Blessed Mother. Mary appeared to them on the Hollyoak tree. Do you know that story? They were peasants. They were uneducated. They couldn't even read or write. But they were shepherds. And one day they heard this, and then they saw the Hollyoak shake, and then this apparition appeared to them. It appeared a number of times. It's really a lovely story if you're interested in these kinds of things. And during one of the visits, I mean, this went from three children to literally like hundreds of thousands of people gathering in a matter of months. I mean, the family had to end up selling the sheep because, you know, there was no place for them to graze because all these woods. I mean, in a way, it was a blessing. In a way, it was a curse. You see? No good deed goes unpunished. Remember that, Alina. So, but the children received this vision of, in one of the appearances, they received a vision of hell and also purgatory. And two of those little children died very young of childhood illness, and they suffered a lot. But on their deathbeds, people would come to them to ask them to pray for them. They're little children, like 7 and 9 years old, and they have such great compassion for what they saw. They would offer gratefully, they couldn't hardly breathe, you know, they were suffering so. And they would offer, you know, a prayer for this person, and then miraculous healing started to happen. People were getting jobs, you know. I mean, it was like all this, these miracles around these children. And they kept saying, we offer our own suffering for those poor souls in purgatory and in hell. What a beautiful gesture. And also, it's very difficult to witness someone suffering. Sometimes you wish yourself you could take that and take it away from that person. But again, that form of suffering, that anguish that we might feel, we can transform that. I mean, it helps us come in union with the crucified Christ. Are any of us suffering any more than that? And he wasn't afraid to take on that suffering, was he? Jesus. How extraordinary. I've done a lot of reading, but I promise I'm getting to a practice, and it'll be, I'm sure, a very meaningful practice for you. I can't say for sure. It's up to you. The sages, the prophets, have shown their spiritual advancement at the moment of their death. That is the time when the truth comes out. Then there can be no falsehood. And a man, a woman has no chance of acting. When the soul is passing from the earth, where his heart was is shown, on the earth or in heaven. Besides, the person who has earned peace throughout life then shows that wealth. He passes away peacefully and with willingness to meet what awaits him in the life beyond. Imagine to be able to have that grace. Just to ease from that one state into another. There is, again, I'm bringing in a lot of Tibetan Buddhism. I hope that doesn't offend anyone, but, you know, there is a practice, you know, like Sufis say, die before death. And in Tibetan Buddhism, we have this practice of poa, which is practicing the ejection of the consciousness out the crown. I have a conscious death. Wow, I would really like to be able to accomplish that. I think we practice that every night when we go to sleep, actually. So bless the sleep, bless everything, you know. Say your prayers at night, or at least remember your teachers. Bring them into your awareness as you close your eyes in your heart. Looking ahead, I want to see how much more there is to read. Just a little bit. Timing, is it okay still? We're still okay. So let's go to this practice using Yahai again. Yahai, this divine life, this active, alive principle. And we remember yesterday we heard that it was an antidote for a deadened heart that's been deadened by sorrow or grief. So one time I asked Piro Mershad Hadayat Anayat Khan, the son of Hazrat Anayat Khan, there was someone ill and we were both together. And I said, it's evident that the person can't do the breath practices for themselves. Can we do them for them and influence them? And he said, well, of course. Well, of course. So we can do these practices for the benefit of others, and we dedicate the benefit of others, and we consider the vibration of the other, just like in the healing service yesterday. We concentrate on the vibration of that individual. We send Ya Shafi, Ya Kafi along that vibration, allowing it to go in. And of course, the person on the list has to ask to be on the list, making themselves receptive. I asked my mother, I talked to her yesterday, I said, remember at 4, around that time we'll start doing the healing service, be receptive. She said, okay, around 4? I said, yes. She's only here because of prayer, that's for sure. And thank you for that. So we're going to couple Yahai with Kayum. I mentioned it yesterday. And I had a completely different practice, but then reflecting this morning on this, I thought it was in the atmosphere yesterday, and it seems maybe even more relative than the practice that I had originally thought. So we're going to work with that practice. I think it's good for our circle to work with this practice ongoingly till the next time we meet. As I said yesterday, please, if you feel an attunement to practice, respectfully ask your guide, your teacher, to help you. And Rahima mentioned the physicians of the heart. I again advise you against picking something up unless it's been given to you or you talk to someone about that, and not just, oh, that medicine sounds good and that one sounds good. Okay. I'm going to go into another document. Just excuse me for a moment. Because I want to read from the Physicians of the Heart. It is so beautiful. And it's a lot of reading, but you know, the mind doesn't have to apprehend it. You just receive the vibration of the words and it will go in, and pretty soon you'll integrate it and you'll be able to speak about these things from your own experience. So again, this is from the Sufi Rahaniyat compilation, Physicians of the Heart on Yahai, Ya, Kayum, and Kayum is sort of transliterated in spelling Q-A-Y-Y-U-M, Kayum. Traditional Sufism focuses on the phrase Yahai, Ya, Kayum, to describe the whole glorious family of all the names that direct us towards the infinite and the eternal, the soul's journey, the infinite and the eternal. It is an enormous and important wazifa, or wazayif, however you want to pronounce it. Here they say, Al-Hay is the life that is beyond the cycle of life and death as we know it. It is what everyone is longing for. Yahai expresses the ever-living, the always-living. What is called the cycle of life and death fade away into that reality. The other attribute of this famous pair of sacred names is Al-Kayyum. The root means stand instead of falling down or falling apart. Very interesting, isn't it? Stand instead of falling down or falling apart. According to Ibn Arabi, remember, he says, I said, try to see God's hidden hand in everything. But he said, seek to know that which transpires behind that which appears. seek to know that which transpires behind that which appears. So here, they're referring to Ibn Arabi. According to Ibn Arabi, the formulation of the sound in Al-Qayyum shows that it is continuously, without a single break, bestows existence to everything. Ibn Arabi says that the very fact that anything else exists, including being itself, is because the nature of Al-Qayyum, which is beyond the passage of time. So maybe this journey of the soul isn't so linear as we think, you know. Things come and things go. They are forming and emptying constantly. That's fana. That's fana. Meaning, sometimes it's said annihilation, but we could say it's an annihilation of the small self in the face of the great self, the great unitive being, of the one and only being. Al-Qayyum says that even after death, all is existent in God. Even after death, all is existent in God. Okay, just a little bit more. Ooh, no, not a little bit more. Well, let's just experience it. I don't need to read it to you. You experience it. Yes, Rahim.
You talked about individuality, and now you're talking about fauna. How does that come together? If we are moving into fauna, how do we keep our individuality?
I think it's part of the same thing in many ways. You know, in the Buddhist terms, which I know you understand, it's the we could say there's a word that they give, conventional truth and absolute truth. They coexist. They're always there together. They're inseparable. These things are really inseparable. And we talked about the soul is an inherent part of who we are. It's inseparable. And that part is an illuminated awareness. It's the seed of God within. It's neither this nor that, as could be said. It's neither this or that. It's this and that. Yeah, it's like they're koans, aren't they, that roll around in our heads till we have those aha moments or ala moments. So we will use the yahai in that very active, alive way, forceful, awake way. And then Qayyum is like touching the eternal moment. Yahai, yah, yah,
yahai, yahai.
What's going on? Wait just a minute, okay? Listen. Yahai, yah, Qayyum. Yahai. Ya Kayu. Ya Hai. 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 Yahai. Ya Kayum. 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 Now whisper just hi. Now, in the silence, feel that vibration of it high, this aliveness, this freshness, this spark. And at the same time, that individuated moment that might be considered a quality of Yahai with the eternal moment at the same time. These two parts that interplay continuously, a singular moment that falls into the eternal moment. You might try breathing in high and out Kayum. You hear the little bird singing it? Hi, Caillou. Hi, Caillou. Hear him? Or her? Yeah, hi. Yeah, Caillou.
May I ask you something?
Of course.
The difference between Caillou and Caillou, which was used by the healing order back in the early 80s.
What? Say it again. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
The healing order back in the early 80s used Caillou and Caillou.
I think it's the same. It's the same. It's the same.
And I first started that with the death of a course of Sam.
Yes. Yes, he often said it, Yahayo, Yah Kayum. Is that what you're talking about? Yeah. And a lot of times, actually, and you know, I think I need to say here maybe that Arabic is dialectical like so many other languages. And so and classical Arabic is different than the various dialects. I know when I lived in the Middle East, I developed an ear for that. I could tell if someone was from Egypt or Syria based on the use of the vowels within the language, so that there's some uniqueness to the various dialects. And so depending on how one learns, it might be a distinction. Do you have anything to add to that, Issa?
No, I just had a small stretch
okay.
that I had.
But I know you have an understanding of these things, yeah. And I know your parents do as well.
Anything I said would be an echo of what you said.
Okay,
but
thank
I
you.
I think that's something we say. It's easy. The O there represents U, and Hayu makes it nominative.
Say that again, so I
can it makes it, it's a case on it.
A case on
it. Yeah. And it doesn't happen on the Kayum because it's
So is it something abstract when there's no U at the end? Or what is it when there's no U?
O and U are different.
Or O or U, what, if it's just Yahai, what is it?
Yahai, it just doesn't have its ending on it.
Oh.
And then we see that with Wahab also.
If it's final, yeah, if it doesn't have
it. It's almost like the Zot, the dot. When Murshida Vera would teach Wahab, Bo, she always added the O. And those of us that she instructed, do you remember the instruction of taking the stream through the heart and going, yeah, Wahab, like continuing the vibration is in essence, I think, what you're saying, Halal.
It's just a grammatical form. That
yeah.
It can be accepted or evocative, which means you call somebody like, hey, you.
Yeah. Hey, you. Yahai, you. Yahai, who?
Hey, you, Yahai.
Yeah. Okay, let me read a little bit more. Just let it wash over you. This journey of the soul. Again, in Murshid and Nayat Khan's words, look at there, I'm reading without glasses now. Okay. The soul upon its journey back to consciousness passes through the world of jinns. Anyone heard of that? Anyone need an explanation of what a jinn is? Murshida Vera would describe it, she would often give it the synonym of like the jinns are like the realm of genius. So she would talk about this journey of souls back and forth. And she liked giving the example, as speculatory in a way, of let's say that there's a soul coming to Earth. And that soul is called Stephen Hawking. And there's a soul going back from the Earth, and that soul is called Einstein. And that in this passing, there can be a transfer of knowledge that can then be continued on. It's interesting to think about that because we see that a lot in fields of study where there's a continuation or a flow or an extrapolation. So, yes?
The little Rinpoche you talked about when you were living in India that knew everything. He's like 7 and he's instructing you. It's like...
Yeah, how does that happen?
He knew everything already.
not only knew everything, one day he started enacting in my room this whole scenario of when his monastery was overrun and what he was doing and what other people were doing, and it was really interesting.
And he was from Italy or Spain.
Yeah, he wasn't even a Tibetan. They had recognized him. He was Italian, yeah. Go Italy. Yes.
When you were summarizing at the beginning of this class what had been discussed yesterday, I thought someone referred to we bring nothing with us into this.
He talks about the soul's journey begins where blank.
Oh, okay, this is before.
Yeah, as we're making that journey, we come blank. He suggests we come blank.
Before we bump into Einstein?
Before we bump into Einstein. You see how Murshid was very careful. I mean, his main audience were Europeans that were from a Christian base.
Yeah.
So he's suggesting to us certain things without contradicting that tradition in any way, you see? He's using the words and the concepts and the vernacular, but he's subtly, I think, suggesting other things in that. I mean, haven't you been somewhere and you just know where you are already? Or do you ever wake up and you're talking another language? It's like, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Seriously. Or you meet someone and it's like, I know you. You know them already. I mean, well, let's think about that. There's something going on there. You know this from your own experience. You don't have to be told it. It's sort of a living reality, is it not? The soul, upon its journey back to consciousness, passes through the world of jinns. And some people describe these as they can be mischievous, you know, they can be clever, you might say. Until finally it reaches the infinite goal where the soul is no more individual. The soul, upon its journey back to consciousness, passes through the world of jinns until finally it reaches the infinite goal where the soul is no more individual. It still has a slight feeling of I, in quotes. It does not distinguish between mine and thine. But when a man has thought of himself all his life as I, he will still keep a slight sense of I. The soul is hindered in its progress by being called back to earth by mediums and sorrowful friends. Suppose a person is going somewhere and all the time people call out, "Please stop, we want you." He will never be able to get to his destination, the purpose for which he is going to be hindered. To call a soul back would be acting against nature itself. It is better to help the soul to go forward, and that one does by sending one's loving thought. And you know, in so many traditions, we offer prayer, don't we? Again, Tibetan Buddhism, you know, we do the whole ritual of that, you know, 49 days of prayer. Praying unceasingly, actually. And if someone in the family passes, you ask the monks from the monasteries, they will come into the family's little shrine room, or wherever that may be, might be their bedroom. And they, if they don't have a shrine room, then this would take place at the monastery in the temple. If they did, the monks would come daily, different ones. So 24 hours a day, there would be prayer for that departed soul to help them on their way. And if it's someone in a public position, the prayer is going on at the main temple with people and the monastics coming and going 24 hours a day for that entire time. And the prayer is Om Mani Padme Hum. This is a six-syllable prayer, and it is to purify the six realms of existence. Murshid's kind of talking about different realms of existence here. So it could be any prayer, but to just help the soul on its journey homeward. Yes?
I was just thinking of Maundy Thursday, where there's constant prayer going on before crucifixion.
Yes.
Stay awake with me, don't fall asleep.
Yes.
Before death, not after.
Watch and pray. There's a song that, you know that song? Stay with me, remain here with me, watch and pray. You might remember that when it's important to. Thank you, Musa. A little bit more and we're going to close because, well, we're running out of time. This seems to be a longer reading than yesterday, and thank you for your patience. I hope it's of benefit. The meeting of a soul going towards manifestation and a soul returning from there may be unconscious. Also, a soul going towards the earth cannot ask for advice or help from a returning soul because his mind has not yet become like that of a human being. He's passive. But you see, also, if he's passive, then he can receive something. Right? What he receives, he gets without asking. Stephen Hawking doesn't run over, you know, to the track that Einstein's on and say, hey, can you give me something so I can keep, you know, building on that? You know, but it's saying right here, I think, Surah, maybe this answers your question, Murshid does. So a soul going towards the earth cannot ask advice or help from a returning soul because his mind has yet not become like that of a human being. He's passive. What he receives, he gets without asking, in the same way that an infant does not ask for something. It only wants to have it. Just as human beings are generally not conscious of angels or jinns, here's another plane Murshid's talking about. So the angels are not all conscious of jinns, nor are all the jinns conscious of angels, although some are. And perhaps those that are more awake or more sensitive. A soul can attract a jinn to help it to accomplish something on earth, and a jinn may attract a soul for the same purpose. Now let me tell you, if you know anything about Inayat Khan, you know that his spiritual quest was all through the Himalayas. He met Mahatmas, he met Lamas, he met Sadhus. You hear it right here, right now. Again, in Tibetan Buddhism, they have could be loosely translated this life gods and next life gods. So the this life gods you invoke and you pray to and you make offerings to help you with something in this life. But a mantra like Om Mani Padme Hum is accumulating merit for the next lives to purify that, the karma of the next lives, and also for others. So it's interesting because we're sort of seeing that come through here. I think I've mentioned it before, you know, some of the very esoteric teachings on healing, maybe Safraz knows this, there's that one visualization that Murshid gives of the Hung. A Hung is strictly Tibetan. And it's the blue Hung moving in space along a path. This is something that's purely Tibetan. Where'd that come from? So again, a soul can attract a jinn to help it to accomplish something on earth. And a jinn let's see, yes. And a jinn may attract a soul for the same purpose. So there might be something that needs to happen through you, and it can and it will. I mean, haven't you ever had someone come back to you and say you were saying X, Y, and Z, and you said, I don't recall that, not just because you had a bad memory, but maybe it was something of a bit of a genius, and they said, I really remember that, that touched me profoundly. I don't remember those words. This is what it is, you see. It can happen in this way. A jinn is not really interested in accomplishing anything on earth, but when it sees what's going on there, it may become interested. It gives you an idea they can be a little mischievous too. Impish. A person who does not go out of town has no interest outside the town. But when he goes to the country, his interest is awakened. Giving us a nice example here. One may ask if a jinn who is sent to the earth looks like a human being. A jinn who is on the jinn plane is quite distinct as a jinn. But when a soul which is very much impressed by the jinn plane has come to earth, it will show something of the jinn in form and features. Now, have you ever met anyone that you think looks a little fairy-like or impish or like a little leprechaun or, you know, those kinds of things? That's because that impression of the jinn plane has come through the physical manifestation. Souls return through the jinn world and the angel world by the same way by which they have come. But the ones who have realized God on earth do not stop there. They go to God while on earth. Ya Qayyum. There is no condition of having to go to God through the outer death. The condition which the Sufis call fana is no crucifixion, for then God is nearer to them than anything else. It's like that beautiful story, you know, we've heard it so many times where someone's walking along the beach and, you know, at one point there's two sets of footprints. And they feel the presence of God, whatever holy beings inspiring them. And then all of a sudden they go through difficult times and they say, well, there was only one set of footprints. And God says, that's when I was carrying you. Someone sent me a little cartoon. I don't know if I've ever shared it. It's like all these people dragging these crosses over their shoulders like Jesus. And this one person's like, oh my God, this is just too heavy. Can I take a little bit of it off? And so, yeah, sure, go ahead. Saws a little bit of the end of the cross off. Mm-hmm. Keeps dragging it along. Oh, still so heavy. Can I please take a little bit of more off? Well, it takes a little bit more off. Have you seen this little thing? It goes on and on. Well, finally, everyone reaches a large crevice in the earth. They take their crosses and they cross over.
Not that guy.
Not that guy. He better learn to fly. That doesn't destroy us makes us stronger. Again, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to suffer. You might just go to hazaratanicon.org and look at what Murshid says about pain and suffering. It's not something we need to bring upon ourselves, nor is it something we should be afraid of. It can carve us out and refine us and make us more sympathetic to others' suffering. It's not something to run away from or feel like it's a curse from God coming upon us if things don't go quite right. Huh?
It's an opportunity.
It is an opportunity, indeed. Just a few more words and then we close. The joy of life is the joy of the journey, not the destination, the joy of the journey. If one could close one's eyes and be put immediately on the top of the Himalayas, one would not enjoy it as much as the one who climbs and goes from one peak to another and sees the different scenery and meets different people on the way. The whole joy is in the journey. Joy. Murshid Alauddin mentioned joy. Murshida Asha mentioned joy. We've been hearing this word a lot. Not excitation, but just joy, pervasive joy, life. Well, I thank you for your patience. I think we've more than run out of time. O thou who art the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, Lord of heaven and earth, open our hearts that we may hear thy voice, which constantly cometh from within. Disclose to us thy divine light, which is hidden in our souls, that we may know and understand life better. Most merciful and compassionate God, give us thy great goodness, teach us thy loving forgiveness, raise us above the distinctions and differences which divide men. Send us the peace of thy divine spirit, and unite us all in thy perfect being. And now take your hands. Thank you for your time and attention. May it be a benefit to you and all beings. Thank you.